Chapter 2 Mr. Nobusuke Tagomi sat consulting the divine fifth book of Confucian wisdom, the Taoist oracle called for centuries the I Ching, or Book of Changes. At noon that day, he had begun to become apprehensive about his appointment with Mr. Children, which would occur in 2 more hours. His suite of offices on the 20th floor of the Nippon Times building on Taylor Street overlooked the bay. Through the glass wall, he could watch ships entering, passing beneath the Golden Gate Bridge. At this moment, a freighter could be seen beyond Alcatraz, but Mr. Tagomi did not care. Going to the wall, he unfastened the cord and lowered the bamboo blinds over the view. The large central office became darker. He did not have to squint against the glare. Now he could think more clearly. It was not within his power, he decided, to please his client. No matter what Mr. Children came up with, the client would not be impressed. Let us face that, he said to himself, but we can keep him from becoming displeased, at least. We can refrain from insulting him by a moldy gift. The client would soon reach San Francisco Airport by avenue of the high-placed new German rocket, the Messerschmitt 9E. Mr. Tagomi had never ridden on such a ship. When he met Mr. Baines, he would have to take care to appear blasé, no matter how large the rocket turned out to be. Now to practice. He stood in front of the mirror on the office wall, creating a face of composure, mildly bored, inspecting his own cold features for any giveaway. Yes, they are very noisy, Mr. Baines, sir. One cannot read. But then the flight from Stockholm to San Francisco is only 45 minutes. Perhaps, then, a word about German mechanical failures? I suppose you heard the radio, that crash over Madagascar. I must say there is something to be said for the old piston planes. Essential to avoid politics, for he did not know Mr. Baines's views on leading issues of the day. Yet they might arise. Mr. Baines, being Swedish, would be a neutral. Yet he had chosen Lufthansa rather than SAS. A cautious ploy. Mr. Baines, sir, they say Herr Bormann is quite ill, that a new Reichschancellor will be chosen by the Partei this autumn. Rumor only? So much secrecy, alas, between Pacific and Reich. In the folder on his desk, clipping from New York Times of a recent speech by Mr. Baines. Mr. Tagomi now studied it critically, bending due to slight failure of correction by his contact lenses. The speech had to do with need of exploring once more, 98th time, for sources of water on the moon. "We may still solve this heartbreaking dilemma," Mr. Baines was quoted. "Our nearest neighbor, and so far the most unrewarding except for military purposes." Sick, Mr. Tagomi thought, using high-placed Latin word. Clue to Mr. Baines. Looks askance at merely military. Mr. Tagomi made a mental note. Touching the intercom button, Mr. Tagomi said, "Miss Afrikian, I would like you to bring in your tape recorder, please." The outer office door slid to one side, and Miss Afrikian, today pleasantly adorned with blue flowers in her hair, appeared. "Bit of lilac," Mr. Tagomi observed. Once he had professionally flower-raised back home on Hokkaido. Miss Afrikian, a tall, brown-haired Armenian girl, bowed. "Ready with zip-track, Speedmaster?" Mr. Tagomi asked.
"Yes, Mr. Tagomi."
Miss Afrikian seated herself, the portable battery-operated tape recorder ready. Mr. Tagomi began, "I inquired of the Oracle, will the meeting between myself and Mr. Children be profitable, and obtained to my dismay the ominous hexagram, the preponderance of the great. The ridgepole is sagging. Too much weight in the middle, all unbalanced, clearly away from the Tao." The tape recorder whirred. Pausing, Mr. Tagomi reflected. Miss Afrikian watched him expectantly. The whirring ceased. "Have Mr. Ramsey come in for a moment, please," Mr. Tagomi said.
"Yes, Mr. Tagomi."
Rising, she put down the tape recorder. Her heels tapped as she departed from the office. With a large folder of bills of lading under his arm, Mr. Ramsey appeared. Young, smiling, he advanced, wearing the natty U.S. Midwest Plains string tie, checkered shirt, and tight beltless blue jeans, considered so high place among the style conscious of the day.
"Howdy, Mr. Tagomi," he said. "Right nice day, sir."
Mr. Tagomi bowed. At that, Mr. Ramsey stiffened abruptly and also bowed. "I've been consulting the Oracle," Mr. Tagomi said, as Miss Afrikian reseated herself with her tape recorder. "You understand that Mr. Baines, who, as you know, is arriving shortly in person,
hold to the Nordic ideology regarding so-called Oriental culture. I could make the effort to dazzle him into a better comprehension with authentic works of Chinese scroll art or ceramics of our Tokugawa period, but it is not our job to convert.
I see, Mr. Ramsay said, his Caucasian face twisted with painful concentration.
Therefore, we will cater to his prejudice and graft a priceless American artifact to him instead.
Yes.
You, sir, are of American ancestry, although you have gone to the trouble of darkening your skin color. He scrutinized Mr. Ramsay.
A tan achieved by a sun lamp, Mr. Ramsay murmured, for merely acquiring vitamin D.
But his expression of humiliation gave him away.
I assure you that I retain authentic roots with...
Mr. Ramsay stumbled over the words.
I have not cut off all ties with native ethnic patterns.
Mr. Tagomi said to Miss Afrikian, Resume, please. Once more the tape recorder whirred. In consulting the oracle and obtaining hexagram Ta Quo 28, I further received the unfavorable line 9 in the fifth place. It reads, A withered poplar puts forth flowers. An older woman takes a husband. No blame, no praise. This clearly indicates that Mr. Children will have nothing of worth to offer us at two. Mr. Tagomi paused. Let us be candid. I cannot rely on my own judgment regarding American art objects. That is why, he lingered over his choice of terms. Why you, Mr. Ramsay, who are, shall I say, native-born, are required. Obviously, we must do the best we can. Mr. Ramsay had no answer, but despite his efforts to conceal, his features showed hurt, anger, a frustrated and mute reaction. Now, Mr. Tagomi said, I have further consulted the oracle. For purposes of policy, I cannot divulge to you, Mr. Ramsay, the question. In other words, his tone meant, you and your Pinnock kind are not entitled to share the important matters which we deal in. It is sufficient to say, however, that I received a most provocative response. It has caused me to ponder at length. Both Mr. Ramsay and Miss Afrikian watched him intently. It deals with Mr. Baines, Mr. Tagomi said. They nodded. My question regarding Mr. Baines produced through the occult workings of the Tao the hexagram Sheng 46, a good judgment, and lines 6 at the beginning and 9 in the second place. His question had been, will I be able to deal with Mr. Baines successfully? And the 9 in the second place had assured him that he would. It read, If one is sincere, it furthers one to bring even a small offering. No blame. Obviously, Mr. Baines would be satisfied by whatever gift the ranking trade mission grafted to him through the good offices of Mr. Tagomi. But Mr. Tagomi, in asking the question, had had a deeper query in the back of his mind, one of which he was barely conscious. As so often, the oracle had perceived that more fundamental query, and, while answering the other, had taken it upon itself to answer the subliminal one, too. As we know, Mr. Tagomi said, Mr. Baines is bringing us detailed account of new injection molds developed in Sweden. Were we successfully to sign agreement with his firm, we could no doubt replace many present metals, quite scarce, with plastics. For years, the Pacific had been trying to get basic assistance in the synthetics field from the Reich. However, the big German chemical cartels, IG Farben in particular, had harbored their patents, had, in fact, created a world monopoly in plastics, especially in the development of the polyesters. By this means, Reich trade had kept an edge over Pacific trade, and in technology, the Reich was at least 10 years ahead. The interplanetary rockets leaving Festung Europa consisted mainly of heat-resistant plastics, very light in weight, so hard that they survived even major meteor impact. The Pacific had nothing of this sort. Natural fibers such as wood were still used, and of course the ubiquitous pot metals. Mr. Tagomi cringed as he thought about it. He had seen at trade fairs some of the advanced German work, including an all-synthetic automobile, the DSS, Der Schnellspuk, which sold in PSA currency for about $600. But his underlying question, one which he could never reveal to the Pinnocks flitting about trade mission offices, had to do with an aspect of Mr. Baines suggested by the original coated cable from Tokyo. First of all, coated material was infrequent and dealt usually with matters of security, not with trade deals. and the cipher was the metaphor type, utilizing poetic illusion, which had been adopted to baffle the Reich monitors, who could crack any literal code, no matter how elaborate. So clearly it was the Reich whom the Tokyo authorities had in mind, not quasi-disloyal cliques in the home islands. The key phrase, skim milk in his diet, referred to Pinafore, to the eerie song that expounded the doctrine, "Things are seldom what they seem. Skim milk masquerades as cream." And the I Ching, when Mr. Tagomi had consulted it, had fortified his insight. Its commentary, "Here a strong man is presupposed. It is true he does not fit in with his environment, inasmuch as he is too brusque and pays too little attention to form. But as he is upright in character, he meets with response." The insight was, simply, that Mr. Baines was not what he seemed, that his actual purpose in coming to San Francisco was not to sign a deal for injection molds, that, in fact, Mr. Baines was a spy. But for the life of him, Mr. Tagomi could not figure out what sort of spy, for whom, or for what. At 1:40 that afternoon, Robert Childen, with enormous reluctance, locked the front door of American Artistic Handcrafts, Inc. He lugged his heavy cases to the curb, hailed a pedicab, and told the Chink to take him to the Nippon Times building. The Chink, gaunt-faced, hunched over and perspiring, gasped a place-conscious acknowledgment and began loading Mr. Childen's bags aboard. Then, having assisted Mr. Childen himself into the carpet-lined seat, the Chink clicked on the meter, mounted his own seat, and pedaled off along Montgomery Street, among the cars and buses. The entire day had been spent finding the item for Mr. Tagomi, and Childen's bitterness and anxiety almost overwhelmed him as he watched the buildings pass. And yet, triumph. The separate skill, apart from the rest of him, he had found the right thing, and Mr. Tagomi would be mollified, and his client, whoever he was, would be overjoyed. "I always give satisfaction," Childen thought, "to my customers." He had been able to procure, miraculously, an almost mint copy of Volume 1, Number 1 of Tip Top Comics. Dating from the 30s, it was a choice piece of Americana, one of the first funny books, a prize collectors searched for constantly. Of course, he had other items with him to show first. He would lead up gradually to the funny book, which lay well protected in a leather case packed in tissue paper at the center of the largest bag. The radio of the pedicab blared out popular tunes, competing with the radios of other cabs, cars, and buses. Childen did not hear. He was used to it. Nor did he take notice of the enormous neon signs, with their permanent ads obliterating the front of virtually every large building. After all, he had his own sign. At night, it blazed on and off in company with all the others of the city. What other way did one advertise? One had to be realistic. In fact, the uproar of radios, traffic noises, the signs and people lulled him. They blotted out his inner worries. And it was pleasurable to be peddled along by another human being, to feel the straining muscles of the Chink transmitted in the form of regular vibrations, a sort of relaxing machine, Childen reflected, to be pulled instead of having to pull, and to have, if even for a moment, higher place. Guiltily he woke himself. Too much to plan, no time for a midday doze. Was he absolutely properly dressed to enter the Nippon Times building? Possibly he would faint in the high-speed elevator, but he had motion illness tablets with him, a German compound. The various modes of address, he knew them. Whom to treat politely, whom rudely. Be brusque with the doorman, elevator operator, receptionist, guide, any janitorial person. Bow to any Japanese, of course, even if it obliged him to bow hundreds of times. But the pinocs? Nebulous area. Bow, but look straight through them, as if they did not exist. Did that cover every situation, then? What about a visiting foreigner? Germans often could be seen at the trade missions, as well as neutrals. And then, too, he might see a slave. German or South ships docked at the port of San Francisco all the time, and blacks occasionally were allowed off for short intervals, always in groups of fewer than three. And they could not be out after nightfall. Even under Pacific law, they had to obey the curfew. But also slaves unloaded at the docks, and these lived perpetually ashore, in shacks under the wharves, above the waterline. None would be in the trade mission offices, but if any unloading were taking place, for instance, should he carry his own bags to Mr. Tagomi's office? Surely not. A slave would have to be found, even if he had to stand waiting an hour, even if he missed his appointment. It was out of the question to let a slave see him carrying something. He had to be quite careful of that. A mistake of that kind would cost him dearly. he would never have place of any sort again among those who saw. In a way, Chilton thought, I would almost enjoy carrying my own bags into the Nippon Times building in broad daylight. What a grand gesture! It is not actually illegal. I would not go to jail. And I would show my real feelings, the side of a man which never comes out in public life. But I could do it, he thought. If there weren't those damn black slaves lurking around, I could endure those above me seeing it, their scorn. After all, they scorn me and humiliate me every day. But to have those beneath see me, to feel their contempt, like this chink peddling away ahead of me, if I hadn't taken a pedicab, if he had seen me trying to walk to a business appointment. One had to blame the Germans for the situation. Tendency to bite off more than they could chew. After all, they had barely managed to win the war, and at once they had gone off to conquer the solar system. While at home, they had passed edicts which, well, at least the idea was good. And, after all, they had been successful with the Jews and Gypsies and Bible students. And the Slavs had been rolled back 2,000 years' worth to their heartland in Asia. Out of Europe entirely, to everyone's relief. Back to riding yaks and hunting with bow and arrow. And those great glossy magazines printed in Munich and circulated around to all the libraries and newsstands. One could see the full-page color pictures for oneself. The blue-eyed, blonde-haired Aryan settlers who now industriously tilled, culled, plowed, and so forth in the vast grain bowl of the world, the Ukraine. Those fellows certainly looked happy, and their farms and cottages were clean. You didn't see pictures of drunken, dull-witted Poles anymore, slouched on sagging porches or hawking a few sickly turnips at the village market. All a thing of the past, like rutted dirt roads that once turned to slop in the rainy season, bogging down the carts. But Africa, they had simply let their enthusiasm get the better of them there, and you had to admire that, although more thoughtful advice would have cautioned them to perhaps let it wait a bit until, for instance, Project Farmland had been completed. Now there the Nazis had shown genius. The artist in them had truly emerged. The Mediterranean Sea, bottled up, drained, made into tillable farmland through the use of atomic power, what daring! How the sniggerers had been set back on their heels, for instance, certain scoffing merchants along Montgomery Street. And as a matter of fact, Africa had almost been successful. But in a project of that sort, almost was an ominous word to begin to hear. Rosenberg's well-known powerful pamphlet issued in 1958, the word had first shown up then. As to the final solution of the African problem, we have almost achieved our objectives. Unfortunately, however, still, it had taken 200 years to dispose of the American aborigines, and Germany had almost done it in Africa in 15 years. So no criticism was legitimately in order. Chilton had, in fact, argued it out recently while having lunch with certain of those other merchants. They expected miracles, evidently, as if the Nazis could remold the world by magic. No, it was science and technology and that fabulous talent for hard work. The Germans never stopped applying themselves. And when they did a task, they did it right. And anyhow, the flights to Mars had distracted world attention from the difficulty in Africa. So it all came back to what he had told his fellow store owners. What the Nazis have which we lack is nobility. Admire them for their love of work or their efficiency, but it's the dream that stirs one. Space flights first to the moon, then to Mars. If that isn't the oldest yearning of mankind, our finest hope for glory. Now the Japanese, on the other hand, I know them pretty well. I do business with them, after all, day in and day out. They are, let's face it, Orientals. Yellow people. We whites have to bow to them because they hold the power. But we watch Germany. We see what can be done where whites have conquered, and it's quite different.
We approach the Nippon Times building, sir,
the chink said, his chest heaving from the exertion of the hill climbing. He slowed now. To himself, Chilton tried to picture Mr. Tagomi's client. Clearly, the man was unusually important. Mr. Tagomi's tone on the telephone, his immense agitation, had communicated the fact. Image of one of Chilton's own very important clients, or rather customers, swam up into his mind. A man who had done a good deal to create for Chilton a reputation among the high-placed personages residing in the Bay Area. 4 years ago, Chilton had not been the dealer in the rare and desirable which he was now. He had operated a small, rather dimly lighted second-hand bookshop on Geary. His neighboring stores sold used furniture or hardware or did laundry. It was not a nice neighborhood. At night, strong-arm robberies and sometimes rape took place on the sidewalk, despite the efforts of the San Francisco Police Department and even the Kempai Tai, the Japanese higher-ups. All store windows had iron gratings fitted over them once the business day had ended, this to prevent forcible entry. Yet into this district of the city had come an elderly Japanese ex-army man, a Major Ito Humo. Tall, slender, white-haired, walking and standing stiffly, Major Humo had given Shilden his first inkling of what might be done with his line of merchandise.
"I am a collector,"
Major Humo had explained. He spent an entire afternoon searching among the heaps of old magazines in the store. In his mild voice, he had explained something which Shilden could not quite grasp at the time. To many wealthy, cultured Japanese, the historic objects of American popular civilization were of equal interest alongside the more formal antiques. Why this was so, the Major himself did not know. He was particularly addicted to the collecting of old magazines dealing with U.S. brass buttons, as well as the buttons themselves. It was on the order of coin or stamp collecting. No rational explanation could ever be given. And high prices were being paid by wealthy collectors.
"I will give you an example," the Major had said. "Do you know what is meant by horrors of war cards?"
He had eyed Shilden with avidity. Searching his memory, Shilden had at last recalled. The cards had been dispensed during his childhood with bubble gum, a cent apiece. There had been a series of them, each card depicting a different horror.
"A dear friend of mine," the Major had gone on, "collects horrors of war. He lacks but one now, the sinking of the Panay. He has offered a substantial sum of money for that particular card."
"Flip cards," Shilden had said suddenly.
"Sir?"
"We flipped them. There was a head and a tail side on each card."
He had been about 8 years old.
"Each of us had a pack of flip cards. We stood, two of us, facing each other. Each of us dropped a card so that it flipped in the air. The boy whose card landed with the head side up, the side with the picture, won both cards."
How enjoyable to recall those good days, those early happy days of his childhood. Considering, Major Humo had said,
"I have heard my friend discuss his horrors of war cards, but he has never mentioned this. It is my opinion that he does not know how these cards actually were put to use."
Eventually, the Major's friend had shown up at the store to hear Children's historically first-hand account. That man, also a retired officer of the Imperial Army, had been fascinated.
"Bottle caps!"
Children had exclaimed without warning. The Japanese had blinked uncomprehendingly.
"We used to collect the tops from milk bottles, as kids, the round tops that gave the name of the dairy. There must have been thousands of dairies in the United States. Each one printed a special top."
The officer's eyes had glinted with the instinct. "Do you possess any of your sometime collections, sir?" Naturally, Shilden did not. But probably it was still possible to obtain the ancient, long-forgotten tops from the days before the war, when milk had come in glass bottles, rather than throwaway pasteboard cartons. And so, by stages, he had gotten into the business. Others had opened similar places, taking advantage of the ever-growing Japanese craze for Americana, but Shilden had always kept his edge.
"Your fare,"
the Chink was saying, bringing him out of his meditation.
"It's a dollar, sir."
He had unloaded the bags and was waiting. Absent-mindedly, Shilden paid him. Yes, it was quite likely that the client of Mr. Tagomi resembled Major Humo. At least, Shilden thought tartly, from my point of view. He had dealt with so many Japanese, but he still had difficulty telling them apart. There were the short, squat ones, built like wrestlers, then the druggist-like ones, the tree-shrub-flower-gardener ones. He had his categories. And the young ones, who were to him not like Japanese at all. Mr. Tagomi's client would probably be portly, a businessman, smoking a Philippine cigar. And then, standing before the Nippon Times building, with his bags on the sidewalk beside him, Shilden suddenly thought with a chill, suppose his client isn't Japanese? Everything in the bags had been selected with them in mind, their tastes. But the man had to be Japanese. A Civil War recruiting poster had been Mr. Tagomi's original order. Surely only a Japanese would care about such debris. Typical of their mania for the trivial, their legalistic fascination with documents, proclamations, ads. He remembered one who had devoted his leisure time to collecting newspaper ads of American patent medicines of the 1900s. There were other problems to face, immediate problems. Through the high doors of the Nippon Times building, men and women hurried, all of them well-dressed, their voices reaching Childen's ears, and he started into motion. A glance upward at the towering edifice, the highest building in San Francisco, wall of offices, windows, the fabulous design of the Japanese architects, and the surrounding gardens of dwarf evergreens, rocks, the Karasansui landscape, sand imitating a dried-up stream winding past roots among simple, irregular flat stones. He saw a black who had carried baggage, now free. At once, Childen called,
"Porter!"
The black trotted toward him, smiling.
"To the 20th floor," Childen said in his harshest voice. "Suite B, at once."
He indicated the bags and then strode on toward the doors of the building. Naturally, he did not look back. A moment later, he found himself being crowded into one of the express elevators, mostly Japanese around him, their clean faces shining slightly in the brilliant light of the elevator. Then the nauseating upward thrust of the elevator, the rapid click of floors passing. He shut his eyes, planted his feet firmly, prayed for the flight to end. The black, of course, had taken the bags up on a service elevator. It would not have been within the realm of reason to permit him here. In fact, Chilton opened his eyes and looked momentarily. He was one of the few whites in the elevator. When the elevator let him off on the 20th floor, Chilton was already bowing mentally, preparing himself for the encounter in Mr. Tagomi's offices.